The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming to be with me, Carolyn Yeager, on this New Year's Eve 2012. New Year's Eve, while for many is a time of partying, can also, especially for those of us who don't party anymore, be a time of reflection. Thus, I'm happy to have two topics on the agenda tonight that are perennially important to me. The first belongs in the category of Holocaust revisionism, which is, when I started the Heretics Hour, that is what I intended it to be about pretty much all the time. But I just didn't foresee the path that the program would take. And in the and the second topic that I have on the agenda tonight comes under the category of German National Socialist personalities and debunking all the lies told about them. I asked two friends to be on the show with me, but neither could due to circumstances beyond their control. First was Wilf Heinck, whose article I'm going to deal with in the second hour. He is having health issues, is waiting to see a specialist, and doesn't have the energy for a radio program right now. Let's hope that he can succeed in getting the right kind of treatment for whatever it is that ails him, and that he will be able to do more radio in the future and do more writing, because he does terrifically good revisionist work. Then I thought of Christine Miller only a couple of days ago, because I was going to talk about photo forgery, and she's really interested in that. But she just got back home yesterday from spending Christmas with her daughter and found that her phone was dead. And apparently it hasn't gotten repaired yet, and she doesn't use Skype. So while it's not much of a party tonight with just me, I do have a lot of great material that I'm raring to get into, so I think it will be a good show. And you, my listeners, can join in the second hour by calling 1-830-443-4911. Yes, here we are in the last few hours of 2012. It's just after 8 p.m. where I am. And I took a walk today, and it started crossing my mind what an eventful year 2012 was for me. Some very positive developments, and then some especially sad things, too. This was a year that the White Network got started, and I don't want to take time to go into the background of that because it's already been discussed, but my mind does kind of go down memory lane at a time like this, and I was going over it again. One thing I thought of was that I have to thank Robert Stark for having Tan Stoffel as a guest on his program on Voice of Reason, where I was at the time, where my program was at the time in early 2012. And I listened to that program, and, you know, I thought, oh, Tan Stoffel. I forgot all about Tan Stoffel. About a year or so before that, he had responded to the show I did about Howard Duff. Gordon Duff. And it turned out that he had been investigating Gordon Duff and done a long blog about him on his Age of Treason blog. And I went over there and looked at that, and I was really impressed with him and really felt, good vibes with him. And he felt good vibes with me. And so we commented a little bit on I commented on his blog, and he responded a little bit. And then I just got so busy, and I forgot to keep going to see his blog. And this brought it back, and I thought, I've got to have Tan Stoffel as a guest on my show. Even though I didn't usually like to have asked people to be a guest on Heretics Hour that had been a guest, and particularly so soon, on someone else's program on VOR. But this was an exception for me, and so I emailed him, and he was glad to hear from me, and so we set up him to come on Heretics Hour, and from that on, things took their course. The first show that we did on the White Network was May 29th, so it's just about 7 months that we've been going, and I gained two more shows, plus, in addition to the Heretics Hour, and got totally committed to radio, so I became very, very busy. And the year 2012, while time seems to be going fast for me these days, faster and faster, it seems that I can, because so much happened in 2012, it seems like it's been, you know, like it's not, it's been kind of a slow year that has really, really been a long year. So that's good, you know, that's good. Sometimes I felt kind of exhausted. I'm glad to have had the opportunity to have this little break at the end of the year that I've taken. Now, this was the year that I also had help with my website, CarolynJaeger.net, which is now only CarolynJaeger.net. And but even though that was very difficult and a lot of things came up because of it, because of all that, all those troubles, things are better now than ever, and I'm better situated, and a lot of good decisions were made, and I'm real happy about that. Other good things have happened, but also the sad thing is that we lost Wilhelm Christman this year. Willie Christman, to me and to all the people that knew him. He was a dear friend of mine and a collaborator since 2007. Whoa, see, I get a little emotional. We worked for a couple of years together, at least a couple of years it took us, I think it was more, on Ein Anderer Hitler, that long series of translations we did and special articles from that book that all appeared in the Barnes Review. It's on my website. And he also did several interviews for the Heretics Hour over these last few years, and I just had lots of sharing with him over Skype, and we were just very good friends, and it's been hard. I actually think that I kind of lost him in July, in the end of June, when he had his first stroke, and I'm sure his family might almost feel that way, that you know, that changed everything. And I wasn't able to communicate with him very often since that time, although I did have some good conversations with him. I was really, really encouraged by that, because he could speak fine, and he was coming, getting his walking ability and all that back, and he was doing, you know, but his age, he was 93 in October of this year of 2012. So his age was against him, and he did have some health issues, and then it was on December 18th that he died from having a second stroke. And so he's now gone, and that just happened. You know, it just happened in mid-December, so it's still kind of new, but it wasn't like it was so unexpected, you know, so therefore that kind of softens the blow. But he was a wonderful man, and I am privileged to have known him, and I have a lot of material from National Socialist material that he sent me of various kinds, and he put it in my keeping, and I'm going to be I got myself a new printer. I've installed it to myself. I'm so proud of myself, because I had a little trouble, but I finally got it working. And I'm going to be setting up a special segment, or what I should call it, on my website. And I'm going to scan and post all that material there and make it kind of a special place for it. So that's something that is for me to, that I can do, that I want to do, and I'm glad I can do it. So the White Network, to go on, looks to 2013, and we feel very solid. And tonight I want to thank all our supporters and those who donate money, which has been enough so far to pay our server costs, and that's really all we really need, but, you know, we could always use more. So I encourage people to donate if they can. I thank those who do and who have, and I thank everyone who supports this network, and I thank the listeners. I have a a good number of listeners now. Thank you very much for being with me here on this New Year's Eve. I hope I won't disappoint you. I think I'm going to have a good show. And I want to tell you that the White Network has a new show in the works. I don't want to say too much about it because, you know, I don't want to jinx it, but it looks promising. There's not even a title yet or anything, but because of the holidays, you know, it's been kind of put off. But I think it will probably work out. So this is a hopeful sign, and I know that makes people who like the White Network happy because they would like to see more shows. So we'll see. We'll probably be announcing something about that in the future. So let's get on with the show for tonight. I've gotten active on my Ellie Weasel tattoo blog again. And in fact, I have now taken it over completely. It's no longer affiliated with Kodo.com or Bradley Smith. Although Bradley Smith emailed me just the other day, congratulating me on my last blog post about the second naked man in the photo forgery at Buchenwald. He said he had never seen that picture. He thought it was very good and talked to me a little bit. Why I'm talking about forgeries tonight is because of these blog posts that I have put up, the last three of them, on Ellie Weasel Cons the World, which is at www.ellieweaseltattoo.com. It all started by a lucky chance that I came across a huge Holocaust photo forgery story based on concerning the famous Buchenwald liberation photo that I've made so much of on this blog because it's the one which Ellie Weasel claims to be in. So as I've always looked at that photo, that's the one with that tall man standing by a post where all the other people in the photograph are in the bunks. He's standing up there by this post with no clothes on, except he's got a shirt in his hands and he's covering his private area there with that. And it's a very, you know, it's strange, but it's very famous. It was used immediately. You can go there and to the blog and read all about it. I don't want to go over that as I'm, you know, on the program here because I've got a lot I want to say tonight. Even though it was famous because it was used by the post-war psychological, propaganda as a kind of a representative of the horrors and the bad treatment that the Jews experienced in the concentration camps. And it was just printed all over the place in newspapers and everything, made a big deal of. So people are familiar with it when they see it. And mostly when I've looked at it, I've been paying attention to Ellie Weasel and his face. And I've spent a lot of time proving. I say proving. People would say I've been trying to prove, but I have proven. And that is not Ellie Weasel in that photograph. I don't know what more you can do to prove it than what I've done. And I'm not the only one who's talked about it. But some people have talked about it after I did my work, or some people have used some of the things that I did in my work that were not, it wasn't as complete a debunking before I worked on it. But even so, other people said earlier that wasn't Ellie Weasel. And of course, it's really easy to see, but for people who want to think it's Ellie Weasel, you have to show them all kinds of evidences as to why it isn't. And then they still don't care. You know, if they're really hardcore. But this blog, and I'm going to go to it now so I can talk to you about it, is titled Discovered Iconic Photo in Buchenwald is Dishonest Photo Fakery. And what I want to point out in this photo fakery is how we don't look closely enough at these photographs, and we read the captions, and we tend very much, all of us, including me, we tend to read a caption accept that that's what it is and look at it and go on. You know, I mean, that's just the way we do. Now, I've looked at this photograph I don't know how many times, but as I said, I was focused on Elie Wiesel's face. And after I had a lucky chance, I went to the Scrapbook Pages blog and started reading the latest blog that was interesting to me. I hadn't been there for a while. And then I was looking down in the comments. I was following them, and a person who has gotten to be on there a lot, Black Rabbit of Inlay, who runs that Winston Smith blog, he deserves credit for having ordered the New York Times article from May 6, 1945 that is in their archives, and you can order it from the New York Times. And he had ordered it, and he linked to it so that we could all see it. And lo and behold, that standing naked man was not in the photograph. And I noticed that, and no one had yet seemed to have noticed it. And I thought, wow, this is just amazing. I saw this as a huge thing right off the bat. I don't know how huge other people see it. I don't know if they think there's some explanation for it. But I went ahead and wrote this blog about it, which took me a couple of days because I had some other things I had to do first. But I did the best I could in exposing the whole thing and explaining it. And I end up in my conclusion, sort of, is saying, concluding that the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which I have criticized many times, their articles are full of errors and their photographs are mislabeled, and that there's no need for Holocaust historians, filmmakers, or researchers to be concerned about accuracy because it doesn't matter how sloppy their work is. It goes unpunished because the media doesn't bring it to anyone's attention. And therefore, people just accept it as is. But we're all guilty of that. I mean, I'm guilty of that. What happened after I posted this article at Elie Wiesel Cons the World, somebody commented on it and pointed out that that two men in there looked very much like the same man. And when I saw that, I looked at what he was describing and I said, my gosh, you know, he's right. And I answered him that he was right. And I started looking at that, and I was just, again, what hit me was that this has been here all along, and I've looked at this picture so many times, and I never noticed that. Never noticed it. And I've gone through the names of these people, who they are, the ones that have identified them, have done all that, and it never struck me. But once he said that, and I looked at it that way, I knew that they were the same person. And now that takes us to the second of the last three posts that I posted on this blog, which is entitled Break the Spell, Magic and Trickery Are What the Holocaust is Made Of. And in this one, I talk about these two people, which is the third man in the second row of bunks and the fourth man in the first row of bunks. Those are the two. And I did a study of their faces, and it was absolutely, and I'm still absolutely convinced that that is the same face. And I describe in the blog all about it, why, and yet there are people, excuse me, who don't want to think so and want to think that they're different. But most people who I have caused them to read what I've written, not just look at the pictures, then said that they did agree with me. But there are people who don't want to agree with that, I think. But anyway, I have no doubt about it. So there's another bit of forgery. And then as people started looking and I started looking at these pictures, I see a couple of guys here. One is right at top of the other in the first person in the second bunk in the third row of bunks, who has a kind of a short hair cut like what we used to call a crew cut, you know, like it was a buzz cut, but then it grew out just a little. And as I looked at those faces earlier, I thought they looked like they could be the same person. I think somebody mentioned it too. But then, you know, I thought, well, I can't really see them. And, you know, how, why would I think they'd be, I can't say that they are the same person when there's no way to show their real face because their faces are turned so that you just see part of it. But now after all this, I'm personally pretty convinced that is the same person, because as you look at them, they just look the same. They just look the same. And now I know that a lot of these faces in this photograph, could be stuck in there, and some I think have been. But since I can't prove it like I can examine the two faces of the two men I was just talking about that I've written about in this blog post, I'm not going to say it publicly unless I could find some way to show. But there's a lot of questionable things about this photograph. And that takes us to the whole idea of Holocaust photo forgery. And there are, and I'll go now to the first new post on this site, which is called A Second Naked Man in Buchenwald Barracks Forgery. I was going through the Buchenwald, photo archives and I came across this. So I started looking at this and I thought, aha, I found another one. And then somebody else sent it to me, but I had already found it. And so I've written now about this one, and I'm sure about this one too. The shadow gives it away. There's always something that gives it all away, like I was talking a little bit earlier about the sloppiness. So the idea is that most of this stuff, probably, if we examined everything that is really... If we examine all this stuff, all these forgeries, all these photographs, I mean, of Holocaust, the ones that are the most effective, too, mostly, there's some, we can find things wrong with them when we find that they've been tampered with. So my comment is that everything about the Holocaust is fake. I knew that anyway, but there's ways that we can show it, and that that we can be working on, and there's a lot of work to be done. Maybe put it that way. There's a lot of work to be done. But what surprises me is that so many people on our side are sort of against this, or want to defend the pictures against the charges of forgery, or not if they're convinced, but it's hard to convince people, and they're afraid that they're going to go out on a limb. They're afraid that they're going to make a mistake, and we have to be careful not ever to make a mistake. And yet, you know, my philosophy is that the Holocausters make mistakes right and left, and they don't care. They're very aggressive, and they can't back up most of what they say, but they say it anyway. And I don't see why we should be so super duper careful and so worried about making a mistake. I always feel that if I make a mistake, and it can be shown to me, and I'm convinced that I did make a mistake, that I was mistaken, I'll just say, okay, I realize, I'm sorry, I was mistaken in this case, but not in every case. And, you know, I don't see that as a big problem. Because of all the debunking that I have done, and that's really one of the things I've done a lot of, I have yet to have anybody show where I have made any big mistake, where I have actually come out and insisted on something that was wrong, and where I was you know, rash or foolish in my judgments. It just hasn't happened, because I'm not. And I have opened up a lot of areas and exposed a lot of things, which I don't get much credit for, but I guess that's the way it goes. Now, to move on, let me go back to my notes. As I said, there are a lot of forgeries around. Let me see. I want to go here. Oh, heck. Go here. All right. Now I'm okay. There are a lot of forgeries, and I'm going to have... Christine Miller is really interested in that. She has a whole collection of them. And when everything gets settled down, I'm going to ask her on again, and we will talk more about this, this topic, because I really haven't prepared a whole lot for it. But there is something interesting that just came up on, again, on scrapbook pages, which I've been more active on that blog lately since this, photo of the, standing naked man came up. And, just today there was this, there's now a discussion about the photo of bears at Treblinka. And I really wasn't able to read the last post that I noticed, the new post has been put up. But there's a photograph of bears that, and it has been identified at Yad Vashem Museum in Israel as being taken at Treblinka, and that there was supposedly a zoo at Treblinka that had bears in it. And, these are big bears. There's three big bears in this picture. Well, now we know that there was a zoo at Buchenwald. Now, Buchenwald was a long way from Treblinka and a totally different kind of place. Buchenwald was in Germany proper. It was close to Weimar, Germany, and it was a concentration camp that had been there for mainly for political prisoners and who, well, it wasn't so much of a work camp because these were political prisoners who were there was work. They were put to work. There's some work being done and so on. But they just were dangerous people in society for the government. So they were put there, and there was this big zoo, not big, but you know, kind of a zoo for the SS personnel. And, but at Treblinka was a totally different place, which was a transit camp on the edge of the general government area in, Ukraine. And they were, it was, there's a lot of, lies, you know. Treblinka has been totally mischaracterized by the Holocaust industry as this extermination camp. And, you know, there's been all this writings, you know, back and forth, and revisionists have written about it and said what it really was, and that this, it wasn't a death camp or an extermination camp. It was a place where the Jews, actually mostly Jews, who were being sent out, you know, they were sent out of the German area, and Jews from all over Europe were sent there on trains, and that was the last stop where they were cleaned up again and disinfected and given some orientation and so on before they left the German area and went into, it was still controlled by the Germans at that time, but they went into the Russian territory and were taken somewhere. And that is being investigated as still as we speak. But there's a lot of pro and con, but the Holocausters want to say that, no, that was their, they were taken there to be exterminated, and like hundreds of thousands of them were just killed in gas chambers in those places. So now they want to make out that it was a big camp, but it had all these buildings and all this gas chambers and all these, you know, I had this zoo and with these bears, and, you know, I think that can't possibly be, but he's got something new here that this was in the commandant's personal photograph album. But, you know, that doesn't mean anything much to me. But that's another controversy where probably these photographs were taken at Buchenwald or somewhere with bears, and then the Yad Vashem says that it's at Treblinka. Well, that has to be investigated. So that's just another example that's in my mind right now. But I'm going to move on now from the forged photographs. I think I've said enough, and as I say, I'm going to continue with this later, but I believe, and I've already said, but I'll repeat, I believe that most of what supports the Holocaust is fake or has been tampered with, is mislabeled, miscaptioned, and so on. And I think that if more attention were paid about that, and if we were more aggressive, if there was more people working at it, and if we were more willing to go, you know, to go out on a limb just a little bit, we would find that what they're saying doesn't hold up. So Now, I want to go on to, because I'm hoping, I don't know how long this will take, but I have a lot about, I have a lot about my main agenda for tonight, which is, you know, Reinhard Heydrich. And I might need more than an hour, so I'm going to try to start that before the end of this hour. So I want to talk about, let me find it again. I keep scooting around. All right, I want to talk about this, this story of the two French Jews who have a website called, I think it would be translated something like Inquiry and Debate. But it's in French, but they have this article that I'm talking about was put on there in English. And it's called Elie Wiesel Does Not Have the Auschwitz Tattoo He Claims to Have. Now, this is very interesting because, the author of this particular article is Jean, and there are two men who run this website, and they are Holocaust believers, and they are Jewish. And yet, they have looked into the tattoo claims, and they have mentioned me in here, so they're familiar with the website, Elie Wiesel Cons the World, and they're familiar with the work of Nathaniel Kapner, who has done a few videos about it, which he really used material from my website, but that's okay. That's okay, they did. The only thing is he never mentioned me because he says, oh, you find that all over. Well, that's because people copy it and it's all over the internet. But, so they're familiar with all that and it made an impression on them. That is a good thing. They say, gee, it seems to them that it has been proven that Wiesel doesn't have a tattoo, and they think that this is harmful and going to be harmful to the Holocaust story, to its truthfulness in the future, and therefore they say that Elie Wiesel needs to do something about it. So I'm going to read this and then kind of comment, but I'm just going to read some of it because it goes faster that way. Our investigation proves, they say, and confirms that Elie Wiesel does not have the Auschwitz tattoo he claims to have in his book, Night, which cannot be considered as fiction, according to him. That's right. Wiesel insists that it's not fiction. You know, people who try to save him from himself and his foolishness say that that book is part fiction or, you know, fictionalized and so on. But Wiesel himself says that it's not. That every word is true, and he means it. And so they go on and say, and in other public declarations, including certain that have been made under oath, and this where they link to my article about Elie Wiesel, where's the tattoo on that site, and they say the number A7713 is... that he made this under oath, and that's under oath. That's the testimony from the Eric Hunt trial in California when Eric Hunt was accused of all kinds of things, you know, kidnapping and so on. Wiesel, and Wiesel testified, and he was asked about his number. Did he have it? And he said, yes, he did. He did have it on his arm. So, and that was under oath in a courtroom. So this impressed these two guys. Plus what Gruner says impressed them. They write, the first one ever to have revealed it with absolutely no media to talk about it was Nikolaus Gruner. They're right about that. Also an Auschwitz survivor who wrote a book about this and many other things about Elie Wiesel. Since we couldn't check each and every story contained in his book, Stolen Identity, we wanted to check the most overwhelming fact by contacting Auschwitz first by mail, then by phone. And they did, they do have their phone call to the, head of the archive of the Auschwitz Museum, who's named, M. Plosa, P-L-O-S-A. And we can hear their conversation with him, on that site. I'll link to that in the program page. And, says that, Mr. Pelosi confirmed the number, A7713, which Elie Wiesel claims, without ever displaying it publicly. They say that it was attributed to Lazar Wiesel, born 15 years before Elie, and who therefore cannot get mixed up with him. So this is what we've known for a long time, well, several years anyway, ever since Gruner came out with it and then others wrote about it. And that is actually why I started this website, because I thought saying where's the tattoo and would be a good idea, and then it kind of grew into more and more about Elie Wiesel. But this still is, the tattoo issue still is the very best attack against Elie Wiesel, because he keeps saying he's got this tattoo. But we have all these pictures of his arm where it isn't there, and he won't answer anything about it, and nobody else will answer anything about it. So it's just a matter of media, total media control and cover up, which is why it doesn't go anywhere. Right. But now these two guys think it should. So now they say, why did we investigate on this question now? And they say, some of you, especially if you are discovering Enquete and Debat for the first time, will probably ask themselves, why did we decide to investigate this matter now? As a matter of fact, Niklaus Gruner published his revelations and many others about Elie Wiesel some years ago in his book that we recommend you to read. Well, his book is full of, I have to say that Niklaus Gruner is right about Elie Wiesel. He's right that he was in Auschwitz and Buchenwald. He is listed as a resident in those camps, and he tells the truth about a lot of things, but he does not tell the truth about what was going, many things that were going on there, and what happened to his father and so on. He's got some very crazy stories in there, which Eric Hunt was so incensed about, got so angry about when he read them, that he just cut off everything, all his anything to do with Gruner, because even though Gruner had been a real friend to him and tried to be a friend of his during the trial. So the book is full of a lot of junk. It is. It's full of a lot of stuff that's not true. But, some of it about the fact that he was there, and that what his numbers were, and that Elie Wiesel was not there, because I find it believable that he knew these two men, Lazar and Abram, that have the numbers that Elie Wiesel uses for him and his father. So, to continue, they say that even though they are quite informed on these matters, which I say not, because they're not as informed about the Holocaust as they think they are, because they've simply just believed it all. But they say they had never heard of it. They had never heard of Gruner's revelations at the time that he wrote them. They say they're not up on things that well. He said it's because the French, the reason they started this now is because the French anti-Semite Alain Soral challenged us to investigate on this particular subject in his 2012 October video for us to get privy to that story. So they just found this out in 2012 because there's a Frenchman who they call an anti-Semite who challenged them to investigate this subject of Elie Wiesel's tattoo. Okay, and they say, then we discovered that the subject was overexploited by anti-Semites, Holocaust deniers, and other Nazis for many years. Thus, Brother Nathaniel, that Sorrell largely quotes, is a proclaimed and clear anti-Semite. A quick surf of his website would convince anybody. Sorrell himself is obsessed by Jews and even claimed to be anti-Semite. So these guys think that anti-Semite is a really bad thing. And they, if you're an anti-Semite, oh man, that's just lower than low. So, they take all that seriously. Now they go on to say, last but not least, Carolyn Jaeger, an authentic Nazi who follows Wiesel since 2010, through a website where she publishes anything that deals with the tattoo Elie Wiesel is supposed to have. Well, that's, They've described that pretty well because they've got the date right. Since 2010, I've had this website, and I do publish everything about Elie Wiesel and his tattoo on it. And I think it's funny, though, that they call me an authentic Nazi. Authentic. Wow, there can't be too many of those around, I guess. But the last thing on earth to do is to offer the gift of reality to anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers. So they're saying that the fact that Wiesel doesn't have a tattoo is real, but, oh, these anti-Semites and Holocaust deniers are taking advantage of that. And they say, to paraphrase the French philosopher Alan Finkielkraut, guess, you know, obviously a Jew, those arrogant anti-Semites are using the work and prestige of Nikolaus Gruner, authentic survivor of Auschwitz and Buchenwald, no doubt about that, who prefers to defend the memory of his friend Lazar Wiesel. And they say he even showed his tattoo on U.S. TV. Well, he did. And then they show the video on YouTube, which is put there by me. If you want to know, it says it's the EW Tattoo channel, and that's my channel. I put that up there. Actually, somebody put it up there for me, but opened this channel for me. I've never, this YouTube, I have a YouTube membership as EW Tattoo, but I have never done anything more with it because I'm not too swift at that. But anyway, it's there, and he saw it there, and they saw it there, and they say that Gruner put this on U.S. TV. Well, it was on a Modesto, California TV station, which I tracked down and was able to copy and promote it. I put it on ElieWieselTattoo.com, too. It's back in the blog. He says, but then they say very wisely, these people are right, even though they don't like anti-Semites. They say, but the real responsible people of this are the medias and the famous people in general who knew about this story and never investigated as we did. Keeping this secret allows anti-Semitism to grow and claim it is based on facts while reinforcing Holocaust denial. See, now this is what I have always warned, that if we make progress in our exposure of the Holocaust, then what's going to happen next is that the smart people are going to say, you know, these people are making hay with our material, and we have to stop that because therefore we need to clean up our act. And I've never really been too much in favor of the holohoaxers cleaning up their act, because I like the fact that they're sloppy as all get out, and you can find, you know, you can charge them on it right and left about all the stupid stuff they're doing that doesn't make any sense, and the lies they tell and the obvious forgeries in their material and so on. Like Wiesel, you know, he is so sloppy. And, you know, I've been able to do a whole, I've got like about 80 blog posts all pointing out stuff about him, which is all pretty accurate. It is accurate. And so, you know, but these guys, they're French, they're Jews. They want the Holocaust industry to clean up some of this messy stuff so that it can't be used by people like me and others, what they call Holocaust deniers. So this is what we're going to be dealing with. So I see this as the wave of the future, kind of. But they say, I don't see it. You know, I mean, it's interesting, but it's something to keep up with. It's not something to say, oh, good, they're going to clean it up. Isn't it wonderful? They're going to expose Elie Wiesel themselves. Well, what they're doing is they're willing to throw Elie Wiesel under the bus, or they're willing to sacrifice Elie Wiesel for the sake of the continuation of the holohoax. That's what they're doing. And, you know, the thing is that the Holocaust industry has not felt the need to sacrifice Elie Wiesel, even though he's very unbelievable and he lies a lot. But they haven't felt the need to do that because they haven't been threatened, because the media holds them together. And so this is really what's important to gain from this. They go on to say that, they just talk about how wrong anti-Semitism is, you know. Weak and corrupt, they affect people with weak and corrupt minds and how dangerous we are and so on. And then this guy Jean goes on to say, end this paragraph by saying, out of respect for and in the memory of extermination survivors, some of whom were members of my own family, we cannot let this happen. You know, they always have to add that they're members of their own family. There's not a single one. There's not a single Jew that doesn't have members of their own family that perished, were extermination survivors. Well, these were, can you imagine what an extermination survivor is? That they weren't exterminated, obviously. So, and members of his own family might have been exterminated, but they survived it. I guess that's what that means. So they talked to the archive person in Buchenwald, and they were convinced from that it leaves no room for doubt, they say, that Wiesel doesn't have that number, that number belongs to this Lazar Wiesel, who's 15 years older and so on. And so they say any doubt and any fraud must be forbidden regarding the Holocaust, as though that's the only doubt and fraud there is to it. They say if they were really going to clean up all the fraud, boy, they'd be busy. There wouldn't be much left of it. But they say, they say things like Wiesel has been overwhelmed with money and high praise for 50 years or so, thanks or because of the Holocaust. Such a famous survivor of the Holocaust as Mr. Wiesel must necessarily be exemplary in his conduct. I therefore call for the international Jewish community throughout the world to the personalities who feel the memory of the Holocaust has something to do with them, as well as the big media, to take their responsibility and force him to answer the important questions that his past has raised. It has to be done while Messieurs Wiesel and Gruner, two personalities affected in this particular case, are luckily still alive, but that won't last long. They're both over 80 years old. Well, okay. Good luck to this is not going to happen. You know, at this point, Wiesel is not going to come clean, and nor is anybody going to make him do it. He's too close to death, and, it's just not going to happen. But anyway, that's what they're calling for. They say, we publish here this article, which is factual, but also full of indignation, bewilderment, and anger, without linking whatsoever Mr. Wiesel to any of the following people. We must realize that recent history provided many frauds of the Holocaust who considerably damaged the memory of the victims and the deportees. Misha D. Fonseca, the one who wrote Survive with the Wolves, they mention, and Herman Rosenblatt in his love story, you know, about that wife of his. And and they mention those, and they say, Mr. Wiesel has no more choice. He must tell the truth to the world. Now they continue on with that again. They say they blame the media. The media don't investigate anymore, despite the fact that they were the defenders of democracy and freedom of expression. They say that's what they said. They have become their first enemy, and they use the example of Matt Drudge, who revealed Monica Lewinsky's story, and the media wouldn't publish it. Then the WikiLeaks and how the media won't publish what we know is against the WikiLeaks. And now the Wiesel story shows that medias don't investigate anymore. Boy, you know, they're finally catching on, but you know, they're right, but they're right from the wrong perspective. However, this is very interesting. And they end by saying that new medias must be formed. They say anybody can become an investigator, a source, or even a quality journalist. Well, that's what we're doing. All of this cannot last any longer. New media is totally independent from the old ones, and from any power, whether political or financial, must arise in order to protect and even reestablish truth wherever it has been silenced. Democracy depends on it. That's the end. You know, they're going to say, you know, people, if they get people to join them, they're going to say that, that they are, they are getting rid of some things that weren't true, and they are speaking the truth, even though they're still going to be promoting the same lie, because I think these two really believe it. These two really believe the Holocaust, and so most Jews do. And many, many people do. So they're going to just be coming at it from that angle. But that's very interesting. I'm going to move on now to Reinhard Heydrich, correcting the record on Reinhard Heydrich. I got inspired to do this as soon as I started reading Wilf Hank's, 5-part article that he, was posted, between August 28th and September 13th, 2012 on the, Inconvenient History Revisionist blog, which is a Kodo, sponsored website. And I have quite a few articles on that too, although I haven't sent anything to them for a long time. Makes me think I should try to do that. But, you know, there's so many things to do. I can't keep up with everything. But they have been very nice to me there, and it's a good site. Now, I haven't been reading that either. I forgot about that. Like I had forgotten about Tanstaffel couple years ago. And, you know, I get into a certain habit of going to certain places, and then if I don't do it for a while, it's not on my list anymore. But this is, I just now read this, even though it was published there in August and September. Now, Wilf is a German-Canadian researcher and writer. He does a lot of good work, and he got inspired to do this because a new book came out, and this book was reviewed, a new biography or history or something of Reinhard Heydrich, and it was reviewed on Spiegel, German Spiegel magazine online. You can read it. I'll link to that too. But it's, you know, it's the usual Spiegel type stuff. Der Spiegel. I don't know if you can hear those booms. People around here are starting to set off their fireworks, the noisy ones. In this Der Spiegel article review, they're reviewing a book by a German historian, Robert Gerwarth. And they say, until now, almost 70 years after Heydrich's death, there has never been a serious biography of this cold-blooded architect of mass murder that met high scholarly standards. Well, yeah, it's that nobody wanted to try to answer the contradictions. It's very difficult to write about Reinhard Heydrich and be scholarly about it, that is, tell the truth and still show him as some kind of a monster. So, but this finally, this young German historian attempted it, and because he did it, and he did still show him as a monster, managed to do that. Even though I don't know how much sense it makes, but they are praising him to the skies. And this biography is currently only in German. Wilf tells us it hasn't been translated, but I looked him up, Gerwarth, and he's only about 36 years old now. He's young, but a lot of historians do some of their better work when they're young. His book came out when he was 35 last year in 2011. And he's very much establishment, very much politically correct. He's a professor of history at University College Dublin. And they say that he brought out a lot of new information that will, let's see, what do they say here? That astonishing findings and an interpretation that will advance the state of research on Nazi criminals. Not true. And as Wilf points out, this is a very standard, politically correct book. And he instead went to an earlier book about Heydrich that came out in 1977 by Günther Deschner. Called Reinhard Heydrich, in English, Representative of Total Power. Now, Gerwarth book is now in English. It is called Hitler's Hangman, Reinhard Heydrich, Hitler's Hangman. So you can tell from the title, you know, what he's saying in that book, whether what he wants to leave you with. But this other book by Gunther Deschner is still only in German, and Wilf, of course, is very good in German. He's born German, and he's decided he's using this book for this essay, long essay he wrote. And as like I said, it was from 1977, and Wilf says that this book has apparently been ignored because it does not meet the quote high scholarly standards, unquote, set by the quack historians, and that Deschner was coming too close to the truth. You know, they call this Gerwarth book having high scholarly standards. But the Deschner book is really more high standards, and he says that Deschner tries hard to toe the line, but, you know, he is much more truthful. He says he was written in the 70s, and in the 70s, Wilf says, is the last decade in which writings close to the truth were still published. So there we have, you could get some truth out in the 50s even, in the 60s, and even still in the 70s. But after that, it just closed down, and everything became, you know, set in stone according to official, world order thinking. So, but he says that Deschner, throughout the book, struggles with the contradictions, trying to fit the truth about Heydrich into what the story and the image of him is, and he's trying to make sense of it. So, that gives me a good introduction to this essay by Wilf and where it comes from, and we will carry on with this when we come back from our break. So I'll see you in 5 minutes. Stay with me.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas vermisset ich. Und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is New Year's Eve 2012 on the Heretics Hour. I again want to thank those who are listening tonight. Very nice to have you here with me. And I'm not going to waste any more time because I want to get right into the Reinhard Heydrich story as given to us by Wilf Hank, using the book by Gunther Deschner, Reinhard Heydrich, representative of total power, which is an establishment history, but it's much more honest, Wilf has said, than this new one. But more than that, most of what I'm going to read you was written by Wilf, and he's just kind of used the book use a lot of other things too. And so I think he's done an excellent job here. I'm going to just read from it and I'll let you know when I'm not reading, when I'm talking or using something else. So Reinhard Tristan Eugen Heydrich, born on March 7th, 1904 in Halle, Halle, and baptized 4 days later in the only Catholic church in the city, was a child of his time. His mother called him Reinhard, strong in giving advice, named after a hero in one of his father's operas. His dad wanted the name Tristan, to be included, as in the Wagner opera. And finally, the name Eugen he was named after his grandfather on his mother's side, who, as professor and royal advisor on the Saxon court, had founded the world-renowned Dresden Conservatory. That was his grandfather on his mother's side. His father, Richard Bruno Heydrich, had also founded a conservatory in Halle. Bruno made his living they called him Bruno for some reason. That was his name was Richard Bruno, but I guess he went by the name of Bruno. Bruno made his living as a musician and opera tenor, and his conservatory was a private school for music and theater. Now, I added, according to Wikipedia, he composed choral works, songs, orchestral works, and operas in the style of Richard Wagner. So he was a big fan of Wagner, which were performed in Cologne and Leipzig. So continuing, he was also an actor and often performed privately as Isidor, as Jews were called at that time. Isidor, I-S-O-D-O-R, was a popular name, I guess, for Jews at that time. And he played the role of Jews in different performances privately, it says. And he had black curly hair, so he could come across as a Jew. The Heydrichs were part of the upper society of Halle. Bruno was the co-founder of the lodge Schlaraffia, which it says that Reinhard later suspected it was a Masonic lodge. He also, his father also belonged to the Mason Lodge, Zudendreidegen, whatever that means. I didn't look it up, but his wife, being the devout Catholic, was not in favor of him belonging to a Masonic lodge. Now, again, I checked with Wiki, and according to them, Heydrich's mother, because you can't find anything about Heydrich's mother, but on his father's Wikipedia page, Bruno's Heydrich's Wikipedia page, there was this about his mother. She was Elizabeth Anae Krantz. Her maiden name was Krantz, K-R-A-N-T-Z. She came from a wealthy family. We already heard about her. Her father was the head of this Royal Conservatory of Dresden. His name was Eugen Krantz. She met Richard Bruno Heydrich when he was a student at her father's conservatory. After marrying, they lived with their children in a second floor apartment. That's all I can find out about her, except that according to Heydrich's widow, Lena, who has given much of the information that is known about Heydrich and, off the record, I guess, his mother died of starvation in the Russian zone in East Germany in 1946. Well, it doesn't say that she was in a camp or anything, but she was in the Russian zone because they lived, you know, in that's where their home was, this town of Halle was near Dresden. And she was in that zone, and so things were so bad there that she died of starvation. And his Reinhard's younger brother, he had a sister. He was the first, I think. He had a younger sister and a younger brother. His younger brother committed suicide in 1944. This also came from Lena, his wife. But the thing to know that is emphasized is that his father was a German nationalist and instilled patriotism in his three children. He was not Jewish. You know, he was a musician and an actor and a performer, so to speak. And he was a lover of Richard Wagner and Wagner's music. So now the sons and daughters of Jews studied at Bruno's conservatorium, however, and Jews were among the Heydrich social circle. So, you know, that's often the case with artists and musicians, and so they don't discriminate too much in that way. They're pretty open. But I guess his mother maybe didn't agree with all of that. But anyway, these Jews who were cultured and so on were part of the social circle. Reinhard was also treated as an outsider. That made him, obviously that made him a little different, because there was a lot of anti-Semitism amongst the Germans in the, you know, at that time, and they didn't all like the Jews, so the fact that he had, you know, was his family or his father's conservatory, you know, associated with Jews was one thing that he might have been teased about. And he also, because he was a Catholic, and that part of Germany was staunchly Protestant. So it says that he tended to be kind of picked on for not, I don't know if I should use the word picked on, but, you know, having a little bit of a hard time for these reasons. And holidays, though, at a Forrester family in the summer of 1918 for the last time. So that's not the only time he went there. But I guess he spent some summers out with the family of some Forrester, you know, out in nature and so on, and working, took him away from his pious musician home. And here he could be himself, gaining self-esteem. Reinhard played the piano before he entered school. And later he took violin lessons. He became very good at the violin. He loved the violin, and he always played the violin even after he was grown up and, you know, in the national NSDAP and so on, and in the SS. He never gave that up. But Well, I'll wait a minute here. He was described as a very good student, according to his classmates. And aside from the regular curriculum, he was also taught French, Latin, and English. After graduation from an advanced secondary education school, he joined the Navy to become an officer. Now, this was a kind of a big move for him because his father was, as I understand it from elsewhere, disappointed and rather shocked at that. And his family didn't expect that. They expected him to go and take over the conservatory of his that his father had started and, you know, live the life of a musician and so on. And but Reinhard decided that he wanted to become a naval officer. And obviously he didn't want that life that was offered to him there. So, that's what he did too. He did it. So, but, things happened and I'm not going to go into it, but it was not as big a deal about his character as they like to make out. But because of some misunderstanding with a girl and him, you know, thinking that he wanted to marry her and then he broke off the relationship. And the way he handled it was not so good. So, and these people, her family were, you know, high up and influential. And so he was caused Reinhard Heydrich to be dismissed from the Navy in April 1931. And on June 1931, just a couple months later, he joined the NSDAP. And he was, of course, it was rather traumatic to be dismissed from the Navy like he was, but he couldn't try to do anything about it or what, but, he joined the NSDAP and sent an application for a leading position to the party leadership in Munich, which was eventually forwarded to Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler. I have some information, but that must be down further about his age. Okay, I'll wait. At this time, Hitler had just asked Himmler to establish an internal intelligence service because of the many leaks and, in the government. And Himmler was on the lookout for a suitable person to head the service when he received Heydrich's application. After an interview and Heydrich in some ways forcing the issue, kind of not letting it sit, you know, wait, Heydrich was hired. And his first office was located in the Brown House, the party headquarters in Munich. In the weeks of late summer 1931 is when the SD, Security Service, was born. For what had been information collected by Himmler at random was transformed by Heydrich into an orderly assembly of files. Doing so gave him a total picture of the puzzle, and soon he discovered that it was not just the obvious adversaries, the communists mainly, that needed observing, but that there also existed another more potent enemy, the international conspirators. Now, to move along and skip through some stuff about his early days on the job and so on June 8th, 1932, when he was 28 years old, so, you know, when he was dismissed from the Navy and all that happened and he joined the NSDAP, and he was born in 1904, so he was not very old. He was still quite a young man. And in 1932, he was, you know, in this job and doing well, and Gregor Strasser received a letter from Rudolf Jordan, who was the Gauleiter at the time of Halle-Merseburg, which is the district that Heydrich was from and his family lived in. And the Gauleiter is like a governor, but it's a party person. It's a party position. It's not a state position. Jordan asked in this letter, he asked Gregor Strasser, if a certain Heydrich was in the leadership of the party. And the letter continued, "There is reason to suspect that Bruno, the father of Heydrich, is Jewish." So, as evidence, he attached an excerpt from the Riemann's Music Lexicon, in which Heydrich was listed, with the addition following his name, Ne Sus, that's S-U with an umlaut, double S, or it could be spelled S-U-E, double S. That actually means sweet, but it's a name that Jews have taken, so it's usually considered a Jewish name in German, but it's still a German name. I mean, all names, all German words are German names, like Rosenberg, you know, those who want to insist that Alfred Rosenberg is Jewish because his name is Rosenberg. Well, that's just ignorance, because even though Jews have taken that name and other type of names with Rosen, doesn't turn that name into something Jewish. They've just taken it and used it and made it seem Jewish. So this Dr. Achim Gerke, who was the authority on questions of ancestry, was informed about this and set to work on it. And 2 weeks later, he assured the party leadership that Heydrich is of German origin with no trace of any colored or Jewish blood. What had happened was that Heydrich's grandmother had indeed been married to a mechanic, Gustav Robert Suss, before Herr Heydrich, before she married Heydrich, the grandfather. So, and she had sometimes referred to herself, just sometimes, as Suss Heydrich, when she gave her name, not just as Heydrich, her current husband, but she included her both marriages as Suss Heydrich. But this particular Suss was not Jewish, according to Gerke. And that was clear, you know, that they weren't all Jewish, and this one wasn't. But then years later, Wilhelm Canaris said that he had obtained photocopies proving Heydrich's Jewish ancestry, but these photocopies never surfaced, and they have never been seen. So William Canaris was a big traitor. He was such a big traitor that it is said that because of him, close to possibly a million German soldiers died in combat that did not have to die, because he was giving all the information to the British, and even to the, I don't know if he's giving it directly to the Russians, but they were getting it too. So, but this, you know, Heydrich was, kind of different. People who get onto things like this would taunt him and bring it up and start rumors about him being Jewish. And this bothered him a lot. And it would bother anybody who didn't want to be Jewish. But he had to tolerate all this. And it's pure rumor and insinuation and jealousy, calling someone a Jew, especially calling Nazis Jews, is extremely popular. You know, we know that, and it's easy to do. It's easy to cast doubt about ancestors that no one knows about. It's really something that brainless people like to do. But anyway, this is what he had to deal with. And he, even when he was in the SS, he got so tired of it, he ordered an investigation into his own background. But even that didn't probably stop everybody from talking about it. But this I think should be accepted as the facts about, so we're done with that. And, you know, Reinhard Heydrich is not Jewish, and it's just one of those things that people were saying. And there was a little bit of reason for it because of his grandmother's, first husband's name of Suss. Now, I'm going to skip to part four of, Wilf Heinck's four-part article, because this is where we get into the Wannsee Conference, which is to me the most important part of this. And so I will continue reading now back to the Deschner book. Wilf says, Konstantin von Neurath, a career diplomat, served as first Reich's protector, governor of the new protectorate of Bohemia Moravia. You know, when in 1938, it turned out that the German state took over that area, and the Czech people were put under German protection. I'm not going to go into all that detail. I can't, but I hope you're familiar with it somewhat. And Wilf says that the Czech people were naturally not happy about that, and who can blame them? Their independent state was short-lived. Heydrich's security service filed report after report about strikes and acts of sabotage instigated by the Beneš government. He was the former leader, a Czechoslovakian leader, who was now in exile in London and causing lots of trouble and wanting to make trouble in this area for the Germans, have the Czechs not cooperate at all. And after the start of the Russian campaign, which was a preventive strike by Hitler, by communists who had now been largely inactive because of the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, but now they were becoming very active because they were encouraged to do so. Thus, the situation deteriorated even further in this area. But Bohemia and Moravia, as it was now referred to, was of vital interest to Germany. One third of the tanks were produced there, one quarter of the trucks, and about 40% of the light weaponry used by the German military. The Western Allies, along with their new ally, Russia, were aware of that and jointly organized resistance groups. A conference of the All-Slav Congress was organized. Some details of that from the book. It's interesting. I'll read it. Immediately from the book, immediately after Hitler attacked Russia on the fateful June 22nd, 1941, Stalin ceased to look upon the war as a contest of rival imperialist powers. It became a war of national liberation in which Russia was fighting the battle of her Slavic brothers against the Nazi fascist beasts. Although there is no visible record of any communist-inspired national liberation movement among Slavic nationals of German-occupied territory prior to June 21, 1941, a far-reaching network of organizations was established subsequently for such agitation. On August 10, 11, 1941, an all-Slav conference was held in Moscow, where no such gathering could be held without official government sanction. It was formally greeted by the Red Army through its official organ, Red Star. The conference called upon the oppressed millions of Poles, Czechs, Slovaks, Carpathian Ukrainians, Bulgars, Serbs, Macedonians, Vlachs, Croats, and Slovenes to unite, to quote, unite against the common enemy of all Slav people. Sabotage war production. Do all in your power to slow down the production of lathes and presses. Exert your utmost to spoil the arms that you are compelled to manufacture for your merciless enslavers. Make every effort to have the tanks, airplanes, and armored cars produced by you soon to go out of commission. See to it that the mines and shells do not explode. Disorganize the railroads. Dislocate the transportation systems. Disorganize traffic. Blow up the bridges. Sabotage the production of guns, tanks, ammunition. Call strikes. Blow up ammunition dumps and storehouses. You know, I've got a call. I'm gonna take it, but I really have a lot to cover, so I don't know, but I'll see if I can take it. Hold on. I have to look at my Skype page now. Hello, are you on the line? Hello there. Well, it says it's ringing. Let me try again. Nope, he's gone. Oops. Okay. I will continue. Sorry about that. I'm always inviting callers, and then I don't have time for them. All right, so there, I lost my place. This was what the Slav Conference was calling on all the Slavic peoples to do. And also the BBC broadcast hourly, work slow in Slavic languages. Nurath, who was the protectorate, the head guy there at that time for the Germans, did too little to curb the activities. And on September 21st, the German intelligence officer and traitor Paul Hummel wired London that the Gestapo had threatened to take draconian measures against this activity, but von Neurath would not allow it. So production of war material dropped by 18% on an average, on average, and 35% in some factories. Hitler therefore decided to replace von Neurath, and Heydrich was chosen as the new Reichsprotector. On the early morning of September 27th, 1941, Heydrich arrived in Prague. He was totally neutral regarding the Czechs, according to his widow, who was not in favor of the move. She really didn't want him to take this job, but he said to her, according to her, "You need to understand that this finally is something positive. I am tired of being the garbage bin of the Reich." So, you know, he was getting all the dirty stuff to take care of, and now he had something that he saw that was a positive, a different kind of a contribution, and he was really happy about it. He wanted to do it. The Czechs had expected the hated Karl Hermann Frank to replace von Neurath, and were cautiously optimistic about the appointment of Heydrich. A few hours after the arrival of Heydrich in Prague, General Elias, I don't know, I'm not going to answer that because I'm not sure who it is. Somebody's been calling on my phone too. General Alois Elias, second only to President Hache, was arrested. The Gestapo had collected material about his close collaboration with the resistance, with additional information having been discovered in Paris following the defeat of France. Hache, as a reaction to the arrest, decided to resign, but changed his mind when Heydrich paid him an official visit one day after his arrival. Hache asked Heydrich to spare the general's life, and his wish was granted. Numerous members of the resistance groups were caught. This is what Heydrich accomplished right off the bat. Numerous members of the resistance groups were caught. About 90 shortwave radio stations were silenced, and the leaders of the groups executed. This is what was going on there, you know, in resistance and traitorous activity against the German regime. Heydrich published all of the verdicts of all of these people who were executed, and he not only moved against the resistance, but also against all kinds of corruption. Black marketers, butchers who sold meat illegally, and merchants, no one was safe. The Czech population accepted this for the most part. They were informed of what was going on, and they knew that there was a lot of corruption. And Heydrich had promised them that things would improve. There would be more food and other merchandise would become available when the corruption was wiped out. And so they didn't fight against him. On October 2nd, Heydrich ordered an inventory of livestock and grain supply to be taken, and said whoever corrected the numbers given in the June inventory by September 4th, now let's get this straight here, on October 2nd, and he only got there at the end of September 27th, and already he's done all this, and on October 2nd, he ordered an inventory of livestock and grain supply to be taken, and said whoever corrected the numbers given in the June inventory by September 4th would receive immunity from prosecution. And when on October 19th the new numbers became known, it surprised even Heydrich that some farmers had understated their inventories by half. So, you know, he had promised them that if they came clean and, you know, fixed things right, he would not prosecute anybody, and so they did. All of the black market foodstuff confiscated was made available to the cafeterias in the big factories. Heydrich expedited the establishment of canteens in all big factories, a move welcomed by the workers because the meals were dispensed free. No ration card was required. On October 24th, he invited 40 union members to visit him at the Hradčany Castle. That's a Czech word. The seat of the government. This was the first time in Czech history that a workers' delegation was welcomed in the royal hall of the castle. After they had voiced their concerns, Heydrich spoke to them, greeted them as comrade workers, and promised that the food situation would improve further. From the monies confiscated from black marketers, 200,000 pair of work boots were bought and distributed free of charge. Heydrich also improved social conditions, raising pensions and established unemployment insurance. The luxury hotels in the spa town of Luhakovice were turned into workers' recreation facilities. 3,000 workers were sent there free of charge on May 1, 1942, 7,000 in the whole of that year. Heydrich visited the workers in the factories, shook hands with them. This was to the dismay of his security staff. And Heydrich was probably too dismissive of proper security for himself. Here he was an expert on security, but he didn't want to take the precautions that he should have taken. And that ended up tragically in the end. You know, everybody has their failings, but what he did, he certainly made friends with the Czech people. And anybody saying that the Czech people hated Heydrich and hated, they didn't. They thought they were quite happy with him. And that's why the enemies in London moved to assassinate him, because he was too damn popular and doing too good of a job and making friends with all these Slavic people. So, to go on, let me get some water here. Slowly but surely, the situation changed. Production increased, and Heydrich was accepted as a friend of the workers, the little people. His wife joined him, finally. She didn't want to go in at first, I guess, but they moved into an estate only 20 kilometers or 12 miles from Prague. He traveled in an open car, even when it was rainy or cold, telling his driver, "This helps us to keep a clear head, Klein." This was another fatal characteristic of his, wanting to drive around Prague in an open car so that people could see him and see that he was not afraid of them and he was their friend and so on. Himmler insisted on a guard for his house. Heydrich complained about that, and he was convinced that his Czechs would not harm him. He was so happy in this job, it seemed. But Himmler insisted on this, and Heydrich worked long hours, some days 20 hours, but tried to make it home whenever possible. I assume that means that when he worked 20-hour days, he slept in his office or something, didn't even go home. But his wife later said that this was the happiest time for her. It turned, because probably he was happy. He was happy, and so she was happy, and it was a good time. Now we're coming to the von C part, and not any too soon either. So I'll try to keep moving along here. Heydrich's next task was the building of a new government for Bohemia, Moravia. And I don't know if they were separated or which government, but anyway, the Czech government, I guess, for both, a government that would be accepted by the Czech people, but of course also loyal to Germany. He made concessions whenever necessary. And these people who were running the government now, the Czechs, were running their own government, but they couldn't do anything that the Germans would disagree with, you know, strongly. But they were ostensibly loyal to Germany and to Heydrich as a Reich protector. And Heydrich made concessions whenever necessary about this new government. And on January 19, 1942, the government was formed. January 19, 1942, that's the day before the supposed Wannsee Conference. And Hache have I been calling him Hacha? I don't know. It's pronounced something like Hacha, who was the president of the Czech president. He had naturally also been involved in picking the members of this new government. To give this government a good start, Heydrich lifted all remaining restrictions on that day. I would say that this meant to allowing the Czech government to be more of an independent government, to be really a fully independent government, except that they were still under German oversight. So, and he also released a number of prisoners on that day, the 19th, in honor of this new government that was formed. And he had worked very hard to help form this government. He played a role in this. And Hache, the Czechs played a role in it, and they all came to an agreement, conciliatory. And at 5 p.m. on the next day, January 20th, Hache welcomed the members of the cabinet at the Hradkany Castle, the government seat, and swore them to be loyal to the Führer, the patron of protectorate. Now, at 5 p.m. on January 20th, this ceremony took place, the swearing in, and Heydrich was there. Hache pointed out that now a new course will be taken and that the attempts by local and foreign bodies to subvert their government and what their activities and so on will be combated. That is, they were really loyal to their German so-called protectors. And Heydrich then spoke to these cabinet members, and he thanked all of them for their cooperation. And this is recorded in a report called Amtsblatt in January 1942, page, or it's some kind of a document, report, or book, pages 557, 561. Oh, it says here, it's the official journal of the Protectorate Bohemia and Moravia for January 1942. That is where all of this is written in there, that Heydrich was there. And then this takes us nicely, Wolf says, to another event referred to by Deschner throughout the book. Throughout the book, he talks about this, he says, a meeting allegedly also taking place on the same date, January 20th, in Berlin, 360 or kilometers, 224 miles, driving distance from Prague, the infamous Wannsee Conference. Okay, we are told that at this conference, allegedly chaired by Heydrich, the Endlosung, the physical extermination of the Jews in Europe, that's what that means, the final solution, 11 million of them, was finalized. Roland Bollinger and Peter Ney published an analysis of the documents relevant to the meeting, the analysis so far only available in German. Well, there is something by Peter Ney on Kodo. If you just Google Peter Ney, Wannsee Protocols, Kodo, or Kodo.com, it will come up for you. And that's what I was, I did a program on the Wannsee Conference in January of this very year. I went back to it, I was listening to it, I had Christine Miller there and I didn't let her talk enough. I'm kind of embarrassed about that, but I was so excited about everything I had done a bunch of research, and I got so excited about it, I just kept talking a mile a minute about it. We didn't have enough time for it because we only had 1 hour. I only gave 1 hour to it. It wasn't enough. So I said a lot of these things, but I didn't have as good a proof as Wolf has provided here, so I'll continue with this. He writes, but even though this conference is now used as evidence for the Holocaust, and the building it was allegedly held in is turned into a memorial, you know, the Wannsee house or whatever, nothing was known about it during the main Nuremberg trial. Nothing was known about any Wannsee conference during the main Nuremberg trial, that is, of the major war criminals. The famous one with, Hermann Göring there and all those big names, and they were all hung. Most of them were hung after it. Robert Kempner, who I've talked about quite a bit in the past, a Jewish lawyer who was expelled from Germany for working against the new regime and ended up in the United States, they returned him to Germany for the Nuremberg trial as a prosecutor with the American team, and he is credited with finding the documents concerning that meeting during the preparation of the Foreign Office trial. There are a bunch of other trials held after the main Nuremberg trial for different parts of the National Socialist regime, the Hitler government, and that was important was the Foreign Office trial. And um, one of the, Kempner tells us in his book, he wrote a book. It was called Prosecutor of an Epic, in English. And he tells us how he found this, this protocol, what he called the Wannsee protocols. During the investigation of the, for the Foreign Office trial, Kempner, received a phone call from one of his assistants who told him that he had found something, the minutes of a meeting at the Wannsee on January 20th, 1942. And at the back of the folder was the remark, Endlösung der Judenfrage, final solution to the Jewish question. So this, current history tells us, is how the minutes were discovered, along with the supporting documents. And when he presented these at the Foreign Office trial, out of the blue, they were just accepted, no questions asked, no questions about, how authentic. There was no investigation of these documents to prove that they were authentic, that they were what he was claiming them to be. They were just accepted. That's one thing that's really wrong about this. But Wolf goes on to say that to list all the oddities, and I would use the word mistakes because oddities is too mild a word, because there is a lot of mistakes on these documents, would take too long, he says. He says that Bollinger and Ney did an excellent job, and he understands that a translation of their analysis is in the offing. But since the timeline is the issue here, Wolf says, the invitations to the meeting issued by Heydrich are the documents of interest. He's not going to get into all these mistakes that are on the documents, which actually I did talk about in that previous radio program. And there's a lot more that, you know, that could be described even better. But you can read about it in various places. On the internet, but he's really going to go into the timeline here. And he says that the first invitation is dated November 29th, 1941, which is true. And the meeting was set for December 9th of that month, according to the first invitation sent out for this big meeting at the Wannsee. But the letter was only received by the Foreign Office on December 23rd. Now, this is one weird thing. Because this was two Berlin addresses, and it took from December 9th to December 23rd for the letter to be delivered. You know, it's stamped as being, you know, accepted, delivered, opened at that time. So there's something wrong there. But to go on, two differing originals exist of that letter, and which we've talked about, and no mention of an Endlösung, no mention of final solution of the Jewish question. The issue is referred to as Gesamtlösung, or comprehensive solution, or total solution, or complete solution, however you want to translate that word, Gesamt. That meeting, the first meeting, had to be canceled, we are told, because of Pearl Harbor. But that's just speculation. But I would say that would make sense, because Pearl Harbor on December 8th, then was such a big deal, you know, because that meant U.S. was going to enter the war, and that to have a meeting on December 9th, nobody's mind would be on it. So that would be a good reason to cancel. So a second invitation dated January 8th, 1942 was sent. And in this letter, the term Endlösung is used. The same guests were invited to meet now on January 20th, 1942, at 12 noon, with breakfast to follow, the location on the Big Wannsee's number 5658. Now, on the first invitation, the address was on the Little Wannsee, number 16, which is where the Interpol headquarters is located. And that is what's typed on the first invitation, and then crossed out and replaced with in handwriting with the Big Wannsee address, but Office of Interpol is left there. Now, the handwriting, this is just one of the oddities of the documents. The handwriting editions differ in the two originals, and that is not the issue here, Wilf says. The mix-up is the issue, for surely Heydrich, as president of Interpol, he was president of Interpol at that time, in his position as, head of security and police of and Germany, would have known where the headquarters is located, and he would not pick this office, the Interpol office, to discuss the mass murder of Jews. The second address is that of, also, some of the guests invited in the first letter were replaced, and even though the second invitation states explicitly that the list of names of the gentlemen invited in my first letter remains unchanged. The thing is that these two invitations are fraught with screwy stuff. They're just screwy. And they don't make sense that somebody like Reinhard Heydrich would be doing things this way. They show signs of tampering and maybe being forgeries. Now, one more issue, Heydrich, who was a stickler, people knew that he was a stickler for doing things right, would never have embarrassed himself by sending a letter to a high-ranking official with words crossed out and then scribbled over. He would have had his secretary type a new letter. You know, he didn't have to do things sloppy like that, and he wouldn't have. So that puts a big question on whether Heydrich was behind those invitations. And according to the letters, Heydrich invited said high-ranking officials to a conference starting at 12 noon with breakfast to follow. Now, it's highly unlikely that anyone would have set the start of a meeting for 12 o'clock noon unless it were an emergency. It would have made sense to invite them for an 8 a.m. meeting since Heydrich had to be in Prague later on and had to be attending whatever it was that was taking place at 5 p.m. in Prague that was very important. And he was there. And not only there, but they were all in fancy dress. And, you know, it was a big ball and party later. Not a party, a ball. And, it was not just some thing thrown together. It was a big, big, big deal. And he was the Reichsprotector. So he was for certain there. And so he wouldn't have set up this meeting for 12 noon in Berlin that he was supposed to attend. Now, Wilf says at that time in Germany, the main meal was taken at 12 noon. The main meal. You didn't have a meeting then. And he says the term working lunch was not known. And indeed, it was not suggested in this invitation because it was said that they'd have the meeting and then they'd have breakfast. Because there's a special word in German for breakfast. And I saw it all the time when I was there. And they put out really nice breakfasts, I'll tell you. I can't think of it. Fru something. It's a kind of a long word. And it's always used for breakfast. And it's not used for anything else. It's not like used for having an afternoon snack or something like that. It's just not. So this doesn't make any sense. Now, to go on to the next thing, Kempner tells us in his book that he wrote that this was a big deal, this meeting at the Wannsee. One had to drive to the Wannsee in winter. It was snowing. The streets were slippery. This is on page 313 of his book. Now, Wilf says it's doubtful that everyone arrived on time, given the road conditions and considering tires and cars then available. And Gerwarth, that historian I mentioned in the beginning, also writes about this. He says, on 20th January 1942, a snowy Tuesday morning, Heydrich gathered 14 senior Nazi civil servants, party officials, and high-ranking SS officers in a former industrialist villa on the shores of Berlin's Lake Wannsee. He wrote that in his book, page 209. A snowy Tuesday morning, Wilf says. Noon is not morning, and according to his calculations, it was Wednesday, not Tuesday. So that's just sometimes how careful these great historians are or are not. At the Wannsee Conference Memorial and Educational Site that exists now, they write, at noon of 20 January 1942, a meeting of approximately 90 minutes took place in the dining room of the SD guest house. So that's been pretty much reinforced that it was started at 12 noon. And it was 90 minutes long, but Eichmann, I'm not going to go through a lot of this because I don't have time to do it. As usual, I've not judged my time as well as I could have or would wish I could have. In the minutes, in these protocols, these minutes, Reinhard Heydrich is not mentioned as the chair, as the chairman. He's not listed there as being present. Yet they say that he was there. And Eichmann testifies, there's a lot of testimony from Eichmann in Jerusalem at his trial when he was a prisoner of the Israelis about how long the meeting was and how Heydrich stayed around afterwards and sipped cognac with him and somebody else. And then there's a lot of this testimony, which doesn't fit with the fact that Heydrich would have to be in Prague. And so Wolf says that it appears I covered that. Okay, let's find the place I need to get to. It is true that Heydrich was in Prague on January 19th. We know that he was there during the final forming of the government took place. And yet Gerwarth in his book omits to mention that Heydrich was also there on January 20th. And he places Heydrich in Berlin on January 20th, not mentioning at all that he was in Prague for that 5 o'clock swearing in ceremony. But Deschner does bring that up and doesn't, and you know, and shows the difficulty there. And also Wolf Dieter Rothe, another German historian, wrote about that. And he said that an important political event was the appointment of a new government by Dr. Hache on January 20th with the consent of Heydrich at the reception in the castle. Heydrich pointed out, you see, so Heydrich was mentioned that Heydrich was there at that reception in Prague on this snowy winter day when it got dark at, you know, like 4 p.m. It was dark, pitch dark on a cloudy, snowy type of day. And then we have all kinds of testimony from Dr. Buhler, which I don't need to talk about. But Wilf Heinck ends by saying, we know Heydrich was in Prague in the late afternoon of January 20th. Would he have been sipping cognac in the Berlin outskirts hours earlier, knowing that he had to be in Prague? Heydrich was a stickler for detail. He would therefore never have scheduled two meetings of that importance for the same day. The von C story is just another lie. And I say, amen to that. And this needs to be written up and talked about more, and it needs to be made more people need to be made more aware of this, because the whole Holocaust that there was such a thing as a final solution is based on this von C meeting, this von C protocol, which is another forgery, talking about forgeries, dream that was concocted by this Kempner. Prosecutor Kempner, a Jew, for the trials and to give some a backing for the idea that there was some, because there was never any order for a final solution or an extermination of Jews found. So this is what they use, and it's false. Now, in conclusion, I want to read what Wolf has written, which I like very much. He says, Heydrich was the personification of National Socialism as a new idea model. If NS or National Socialism would have looked into the mirror, the picture of Heydrich would have looked back. Professor Ernst Nolte, an expert on National Socialism, stated that most National Socialist personalities had an unidentifiable identity. Not so Heydrich. He was homogeneous. He had an identifiable identity. I'm not real clear about that, what that means, but He had been able, Wolf says, to assemble the most intelligent National Socialist people around him. He was not burdened by party politics, but realized that for a revolution to be successful in a highly advanced industrialized nation as Germany, it would be necessary to have people of intelligence and conviction in all important positions. And it's true that Heydrich was critical of a lot of party people and, you know, party politics and stuff like that. He was a loyal party member, but he wasn't crazy about party stuff of the party. And he was more interested in what Germany was going to create for Europe. And Wolf says traitors and enemies of this new ideal had to be removed. And that's how Heydrich saw it, that if you have to do that. And I agree with that for sure. Even in our movement today, traitors and enemies of what we stand for have to be removed. Two Vaticans are issuing encyclicals today, Heydrich told his officers. This is a quote. One is located in Rome and the other in Moscow, and we are the heretics of both religions. He was very suspicious of establishment Roman Catholicism based on like the Vatican, the Pope, etc. He was not against anybody's religion. He was tolerant of all the religions and of Protestants and Catholics in Germany and all of that. It wasn't just the people and their beliefs. It was the establishment, the institutionalized church. Now, he was also not really committed to National Socialist ideology, but instead to his conviction that a new order must be created. This is according to Wolf. Hatred of Slavs or Czechs was foreign to him. He told German officials at the beginning of his tenure in Prague that pacifying the Czechs was his mission and that he would work with anyone committed to that. He did not spare Germans who were negligent. No, he did not stand up for Germans who were doing wrong. And the Nazi party didn't do that, and Hitler didn't do that, and all these harsh rules for Germans in the Wehrmacht or in the SS or in the government were very strict on Germans even though they were German people, who were breaking the rules, who were engaging in criminal activity or whatever. Very, very strict on their own people. So this ends my program here, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you got something from it. There are ideas here that we have to promote, we have to propagate, and we have to get people to hear all this, because as I said in my announcement, it will change the face of history, you know, because history is based on these lies that are so easily, really, maybe not so easily, but people have done the work to make them visible to us. And this may be a theme, one of my themes this coming year in 2013, but I hope we make a lot of progress in this. Thank you so much for listening tonight. A happy new year to everyone, to all of you, and to all of our supporters. A very great new year for everyone. Let's look forward to it. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.